Hello, everybody, and welcome to the podcast. That sounded quite professional, and I am not one of those. Hey, this is going to be an interesting podcast. We've got coming up here, we've got an announcement about the future of Charterhouse Real Estate. I've been talking about that for a while, so I'm going to tell you exactly what's happening with that. We were going to have the great Ross Peterson on today, but he had to do something else, which is fine. So we'll welcome Ross back another time. But we've got the great Jared Stansberry in the house today.
What up, dude? I'm the acting publisher of CycloneFanatic.com right now.
How does that feel?
Chris put something in our Slack conversation about it, and I put in the video of Dwight Schrute from The Office when Michael names him the manager when he thinks he's going to get the job at corporate, and he's sitting there with Jim. He says, "Welcome to Hotel Hell," or the Hell Hotel, or whatever it is. Yeah, that's what I said that everybody at Cyclone Fanatic is in right now.
I missed The Office, man. What a great show that was. It's funny because a friend of mine, we'll talk, the other thing I didn't plug is, and don't get bored with this because this is actually going to be, I think, a fairly cool discussion. We're going to talk a little about Bitcoin. Now, I know as people say that, I think pretty much everyone's heard of Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people don't have any clue what it is, what it's about, where it's going, et cetera, other than the price is going through the roof right now. So I definitely have a take on Bitcoin. And hopefully try to simplify what the heck Bitcoin is. And I'll give away the secret here, why I think it's going to fail. A lot of people would disagree with that, but we'll get into that. So I wanted to... And by the way, there's an Iowa State game tonight. So I think we'll talk about that a little bit. But hey, when I lead the show, we tend to go into these other topics. So
it's okay. I'm not concerned about it.
Chris will be here hopefully next week, and we can talk a little bit more sports. So I wanted to start with a magic trick, and we've never done one of these on the podcast, and I'm going to attempt to read your mind.
Okay.
Here's the trick, and the thing is about this, stay with us because I'm going to explain this at the end. I might be able to read his mind, I might not, but thousands of you are going to be trying this exact same trick on your friends and family after I do this, all right? So it requires a little bit of math, but what I'm going to do here is I'm going to write down the answer that you're going to provide.
Okay.
All right? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to do that right now. And then I'm going to fold this up so it's in place. And we're going to see how close I get.
Okay.
Okay, I might nail it. I might not, but it just depends. Okay. So I've written down your answer. I'm going to fold this up, and I'm going to place it right here so I can't alter it. Okay, the answer is down. Okay, so in order to do this trick, and I'll repeat this again so you guys can try this on your families, and I guarantee you will if you can remember how this trick goes. Okay. Don't tell me any of your answers as you go along. Just think about them in your head. All right? And do this at home. If you're listening now, do this as well at the same time. All right. Pick a number between 1 and 10. Okay, you've got your number.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're going to multiply that number by 2.
Okay.
Okay. Now you're going to add 8 to that number. Okay? Now you're going to divide that number by 2. Okay, he's still with me. He's nodding in agreement.
Yeah.
All right. Now think of the original number that you picked and subtract it from the number that you are currently at.
Okay.
Okay, that's going to leave you with a number. Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, the next step is you're going to assign a letter to the number that you have. Okay, so if your number is 1, it'd be A, 2B, 3C, so on and so forth. Okay?
Yeah.
You've got the letter in your head?
Yeah.
Okay. I want you to think of the first country that starts with that letter.
Okay.
He may be stumped on this part.
No, I got it.
All right, he's got one.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, you're going to go up in the alphabet one letter. Okay, so if you were at A, you're going to go to B. If you were at B, you're going to go to C, so on and so forth. Okay, mm-hmm. You've got that letter?
Yeah.
Okay, now I want you to think about the first animal that starts with that letter. Got it?
Yep.
Okay. Now, what I want you to do, one more step, think about the color that animal is.
Got it?
Okay. So, we're going to see how close I am now to reading your mind, okay? This is what I wrote down. We're going to also find out how good Jared is at math. All right. This is what... Read what I wrote and tell me how close I am.
Okay, what is this word?
Denmark.
Okay, well, yeah, you got that right. And then I had eagle and brown.
Okay.
So, you got one right.
Got one of three. So, here's what's interesting. So, if you do this trick... It's better, works better when you've got multiple people at the table, right? Because odds are, and this is what's cool about this trick, odds are you're going to at least match with somebody and maybe multiple people. Mm-hmm. And the way the trick works, the cool thing about this thing is it does not matter what number that you picked at the beginning. The way the math works out, you always end at 4.
Yeah.
Whether it's 3, 8, 9, doesn't matter. The pattern, that sequence is always going to get you to 4. Once you've gotten somebody to 4, then you're going to get them to D mm-hmm. automatically.
Right. Now here's just guessing after that.
Well, here's where it almost everybody picks Denmark
yeah.
in this trick. There's 3 countries that start with D. One is Denmark. The other one is Dominican Republic.
And
Djibouti.
That's the other one that I thought of.
Is the third one. And yeah. most people aren't going to think Djibouti, right? So now it's between Denmark and Dominican Republic.
Yeah.
I've tried this on a number of people. Almost everybody picks Denmark. You go up one letter, you're at E. I would say 80% of people have chosen elephant.
I didn't even think of elephant. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just, you know, and that's why.
Very patriotic. Yep. Of the eagle.
And that's why you're not going to get it right for everybody
yeah.
because there's choices. But for the people that do pick gray elephant in Denmark and you've matched them, they're like, what the heck? How did that happen? Well, the whole trick obviously relies on the math at the beginning.
Right.
I've had somebody, I told somebody this thing, I went through it with them, and they ended up with, I think it was a brown cow in Canada. Or something, which told me right away they were at 3
yeah.
versus 4, so the math got screwed up.
Well, see, then you can also find out which of your friends are good at math and which ones aren't.
It's pretty simple math, but yeah, a lot of people just hear math and they automatically shut down. So for those that are listening, definitely try to blow some minds tonight. So the pattern, again, pick a number between 1 and 10, and then you go times 2 plus 8 divided by 2, subtract the original number. That's going to get them to 4, and from there it's country. And you don't even need to do the color part at the end. It's, you know, a number of people would be impressed just with elephant in Denmark
right.
if you could get that.
Yeah.
So I've had reactions from people that say, oh, I know how you did it because of the math. And I've had people that have said, what in the world?
Yeah.
How did you do that?
Yeah.
So there's my magic trick for people moving forward. And I guarantee you we're going to have some people trying this at the dinner table tonight.
Somebody's going to come up to me at the basketball game tonight and probably try and do that to me now. I just have a feeling.
Well, yeah, they'd be stupid for trying it again if they listen to this. But so anyway, so I've been trying to get into my son, who's 6, it likes to watch videos before bed. Sometimes I'll lay in there with my phone and he'll watch.
Yeah.
Did you ever watch the show Wipeout?
Yeah,
on ABC.
Yeah,
he loves that, laughs at people falling in the water and stuff. That's great. But we started watching some magic tricks, and this was one of those. And it's cool. There's a lot of magic tricks that kids can do that are pretty simple. This one was a little bit advanced for a normal 6-year-old, I guess. But just making things disappear and stuff. So that's my stage of fatherhood right now.
Are kids still into like the slime?
You
know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I know for a while they were making the slime with all the weird stuff, and then a bunch of schools had to ban it because I think kids were like getting burnt by it and all
this
stuff.
You know what's crazy is the stuff that catches on and is popular on YouTube specifically. Like so my daughter's 3, she'll watch this stuff for hours. Even my 6-year-old likes it. Things like just little surprise boxes. So you're watching this video and it's really kind of nothing but some dude's hands.
Yeah.
And he'll have like an egg, like those eggs are in vending machines, the plastic Easter eggs. And he'll make a big show about what's in the egg and let's find out. And kids are glued to this stuff. This guy's probably making millions of dollars off of the fact that it's like, oh my God, what's in it? And you know, you open it and it's a piece of crap. Doesn't even matter what's in it, but kids are excited. And then they want to see what's in the next egg and on they go. I'm jealous of those videos. It's like, that's all I needed to do to make a crap load of money is do that crap.
Well, I know that there's people that are still able to make money opening baseball card packs and stuff like that. Kids will just sit there and watch other people open packs of baseball cards.
I know. Were you ever into that? Did you get into baseball cards?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I loved baseball cards when I was younger. My dad had a big collection that he showed me. I still have a bunch of them at my house.
So one of my, I know you would know the name, even though you're a young dude, Jose Canseco.
Yeah,
was a big time player, and I want to say it was Canseco. I might be mixing up a couple of different card stories, but I remember very specifically there was some cards that came out that Kmart carried back when Kmart was still around. It's closing mm-hmm. everywhere. But these cards came in a see-through package. So you'd go to this bin at Kmart, and these cards would be seen in there. So you could see clearly who the first player was in the pack, but you couldn't really see the rest. And I remember spending what seemed like hours with my dad kind of picking these things up and not opening them, but there was enough room within the pack that you could kind of get the cards over to one side.
Yeah.
And then using your fingers, you could kind of slowly move them off of each other to where you could see enough of the card below that when you found the one that we were looking for, and again, I think it was Jose Canseco, which at the time, this would be, you know, $50 card or whatever.
Right, yeah.
And it was like this treasure hunt to try to find this, you know, cheating the system a little bit. You could look at it that way too. But it was exciting when you came across this one card and it was, you know, cost $2 for the pack, but you knew it was a winner.
That's actually kind of interesting. I was riding with the Uber driver one day and he was telling me that for the past like 15 years or something like that, he's worked for a company that distributes baseball cards.
Really?
And his whole job is that when cards will come off of the assembly line or whatever, they come out back from getting shipped from a store and they come back, they had a surplus or something, he will sit there and he'll have a stack of what they call A cards, which is like the big name guys. You know, it'd be like a Chris Bryant or Rizzo or Mike Trout, guys like that.
Yep.
He'll sit there with those and he has a box. He has boxes. He'll put one of those on the top and then he just gets big stacks and they're rubber banded. He just takes the rubber band off, puts it in there.
Yep.
And those are all the crappy ones.
Yep.
And that's how they do it. They put them in those boxes and then they'll sell those cards that way. And that's his whole job, is he just puts these cards in boxes all day.
So I don't even know. Do you know how prevalent baseball cards are today?
They aren't very prevalent.
Because they went down the toilet for a while. It used to be where I remember growing up, and I know a lot of kids my age did this, grabbing the price guide that they had.
Yeah.
And you'd grab a card and you'd look it up and it was 3 cents. Like 3 cents was the crap, right? But then you get one, it's like $2.50. And as a 8-year-old or a 10-year-old, you're like, man, I'm really accumulating some wealth here. That's what it felt like.
Yeah.
And then I think just too many people entered the market.
Yeah, just the bubble burst with it. Yeah.
Yeah, so great memories of doing it. I remember another one. It wasn't a baseball card. There was a pack that looked – the package on the outside looked a little bit like what a taffy – like taffy would look like if you go get Laffy Taffy in like the longer version. So it was lengthwise a decent size but not that big. And it was coins on the inside. There were three – coins in it, and the metal of the coin was like pink, blue, gold, whatever, and then it had a picture of the player. And I grew up in Ames over by the mall, and I remember very specifically they used to sell these at a place called Rexall, which was a drugstore. It's long vanished from the face of the earth, but they were probably, when I was growing up, these things were probably 50 cents a pack or whatever. And I would get on my bike with my buddies and ride over around the mall parking lot, and there were some apartment buildings close by. And maybe this is where my entrepreneurial passion came from. The sole goal was to go around looking for either money on the ground, like quarters or dimes or whatever.
Yeah.
The mall had a lot of that. So, you know, I found a $20 bill over there once. It was the greatest day of my life. But I'd look for pop cans and you know, mainly pop cans. Did dumpster diving for that, and then would immediately take my pop cans to the grocery store, which was right next to the drugstore, and go get my money, 5 cents a piece, and run down and buy a pack and see who I could get until I had this completed collection, which was 40 or whatever. I lived for that crap. You know, those are the things you miss a little bit when you turn into an adult. You don't look forward to that type of stuff. But those are like the best memories of childhood, doing that.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it was I don't know, this is a little bit different of a story, but when my grandpa, he really liked, he had a lot of collection stuff that he just had accumulated over the years. When he passed away in 2014, I got a call from my dad one day, and he said, hey, do you know whatever happened to the Mickey Mantle rookie card that grandpa had? No, I didn't even know that he had it.
Yeah.
And he'd apparently had this card for 15 years or something like that, and it disappeared. They've still, to this day, have never found it.
Don't know where it is.
Don't know where it is. And it's, I mean, of all the cards that are still out there, that's probably one of the ones that's worth the most. It was a mint condition Mickey Mantle rookie card.
What's amazing about cards like that is the fact of their age, and that many, many, many years later, not that they exist, but they're still in mint condition.
Yeah.
Somebody kept them that nice
for
all those years. I remember the feeling of like accidentally bending a corner of a card. Like, oh man. Or you get cards. Just the fact of mint condition means it is perfect in every way. But cards are cut by machines, and sometimes you'd get a card that was off center, and there's nothing you can do about that. But yeah, that industry, and the story about the Mickey Mantle card reminds me of a movie I just saw on Netflix. I don't want to plug it because it's not that type of movie. It's just interesting. And this does relate to the baseball cards. But I just watched this movie on Netflix the other day called The Voyeur. And...
Did you see it? I was just going to tell you about that. Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, the guy had a baseball card collection.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, which is really not the point of the story at all. But for anybody that's looking for something interesting to watch, the premise of this movie and all, it's a documentary, sum it up very quickly. This guy, this self-proclaimed voyeur, and I think most people know what a voyeur is, but basically someone that likes to watch people have sex and spy on them, a peeping Tom, knew he was one from a young age and eventually got to the place where he wanted to buy a motel, but a specific type of motel in which he would be able to watch people in their rooms. So this guy searched and searched and finally found one that had a pitched roof, so it would have attic space, went up there before it was open, and created vents in the ceilings so he could watch people do everything, really, not just have sex, obviously, but watch TV or fight or whatever. And the story is this journalist by the name of Gay Talese. He's a
very famous journalist.
Yeah, famous guy, old.
Wrote the Frank Sinatra Has a Cold, regarded as one of the best.
And did Thy Neighbor's Wife, I think, which was about sex in America. So anyway, this journalist, though, and this is a moral question, in my opinion, a moral dilemma. The voyeur back in like the 80s or whenever it was, knew that this journalist had written books about sex, et cetera, and contacted him, reached out and contacted him and said, I want you to come check out this hotel. The journalist goes up into the attic space with him and watches. He tells a story about watching at least one couple having sex, all right, and leaves, you know, just doesn't write a story, leaves. And then this, some 30 years later, these two are working together to write this book about his experiences being a voyeur. Now, as the problem I have with that is, okay, this is a crime this guy is committing. You can't just do this. There's repercussions to this. The journalist has involved himself in the story. He knows that it's going on. Where's the line of from a journalist's perspective of reporting activity that you know is criminal versus saying, it's none of my business and I'm going to profit off of it later by writing a story?
Well, especially, I mean, I don't want to give too much of it away because, there's a
lot
more.
It leads to more.
Right. It leads to even more stuff that that creates even more of a moral issue of whether or not the guy should have been, you know, telling people that this stuff was happening. But the book came out in July, I want to say.
Yeah.
And, you know, it all kind of comes unraveled. And it, yeah. I mean, it was super interesting. I just was at the Ames Library trying to kill time the other day.
Yeah.
And I put it on and I was hooked. I was like, man, this is phenomenal.
Yeah. So it is, you know, and it's not graphic. I mean, it's a documentary. They show some flashback footage.
It's more just about the two guys and like how they
put
the story
together. I think I'm honestly going off of memory here. I think there's maybe a bit of nudity for people that are maybe going to check this thing out.
Yeah,
I think.
Maybe a little bit. Yeah,
but it's nothing graphic. But it's just very, very interesting on how this guy that is quite frankly a pervert.
Yeah.
Speaks so openly about being a pervert with no shame.
Well, he's almost proud of it.
About what he did.
Yeah, he's proud of it.
He's proud that he did it without getting caught. He's proud of... so it was fascinating in that sense. So it's on Netflix. It might be elsewhere, but it's on Netflix. It's called The Voyeur.
Have you watched the Jim and Andy documentary?
I did, yeah. That was interesting, too.
Yeah, that one was...
Andy Kaufman and Jim Carrey's portrayal of him.
Well, it makes a lot more sense why he hasn't been in any... really been in any movies since then.
Yeah.
Now.
Yeah. What was interesting about that is Jim Carrey, while he filmed Man on the Moon, I think, is the name of the movie, right?
Yeah.
About the life of Jim Kaufman.
Which is actually a really good movie.
Or Andy Kaufman. Yeah, it is a good movie. And Jim Carrey stayed in character the whole time. So it's some behind-the-scenes footage of that movie and how that went and how he interacted with people. And then Jim Carrey also played Tony Clifton, who was always linked to Andy Kaufman. And that guy would be tough to be around.
Yeah.
And again, once he was in the character of Tony Clifton, he stayed in that character. And just watching, you need to see the movie, I think, to have the full context. Obviously, seeing the movie and then watching this would probably be good. But no, it was brilliant. It was brilliant. I haven't seen that movie's at least, it's got to be at least 10 years old, right, at this point?
I think that was like, I don't know, probably 1998 or 1999.
Even older.
That came out, yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, great movie, but long ago. So, you mentioned a bubble, the baseball card thing. So, I want to talk a little bit about Bitcoin, and then I'm going to say what the heck we're doing here at Charterhouse. So, I've got, where do you side on Bitcoin? Let me start the conversation that way. What do you think about Bitcoin, or what do you think, what comes to mind when you think about it?
I don't really get it. I'll be honest. I just
I'm with you. I don't
fake
get it
to me. Okay. I guess is how I would put it. Like, I don't know what can you even do with it.
That's just it. That's the issue. So, don't fall asleep if you're listening to this, because this is interesting. And there's a couple things specific I'll talk about that are issues with Bitcoin, but we're going through this phenomenon right now with Bitcoin.
It's up to like 15,000 today, isn't it?
Yeah. So one Bitcoin equals 15,000 bucks. So here's the thing. Smart people, smart economists, the Warren Buffetts of the world, et cetera, are saying don't get involved with Bitcoin. Essentially what Bitcoin is some, and here's a problem. Here's where the problem starts. Nobody knows who created Bitcoin. Okay. There's a guy named, I think it's Satoshi Nakamoto. That I might butcher that name a little bit, but there's a guy, okay, that created Bitcoin. And when you say created Bitcoin, it's not a physical thing. A Bitcoin is not a quarter that you can hold in your hand.
Right.
It is. Bitcoin revolves around really complicated algorithms on a computer.
You have to mine it?
Yeah. And so there's people that mine Bitcoins. You think about mining something, you think about a shovel in the dirt, right? So this started differently. So this is a computer algorithm that uses something called a blockchain, which tracks every transaction, and it's public in that way. And what Bitcoin really started, or why it started, one of the main reasons was because money is so easily traceable when it's not in cash. And cash is tough to deal with in large amounts. So if you want to, as an example, if you do a transaction at your bank of over $10,000, they report that. Mm-hmm. Okay, they have to file a report. So Bitcoin is anonymous, and Bitcoin was created so people could do commerce, trade with each other on what was called the Silk Road, which is basically black web internet, buy drugs, pay for stuff that's not legal anonymously, right? So it was a way to kind of get around. Our currency is backed by the Fed, and the government regulates it, et cetera. Bitcoin is regulated by nobody.
Yeah.
Okay. But what makes this whole thing very interesting is what is value? Where does it come from, right? What is a dollar bill? A dollar bill is nothing but a piece of paper, but you and I agree that's worth something. And part of the reason it's worth something is because if I have one, I can go do something else with it, right? So herein lies the problem with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is this digital currency that you cannot spend in most places. You can't go currently to Amazon and buy anything with Bitcoin. You can't go to Starbucks and buy anything with Bitcoin. Just today, I saw an article. I wasn't familiar with the site, but a site called Steam, I think, which is video games.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. So a big player in that market, right, has come out and said they had been taking Bitcoin, but now they're not because of the volatility of what's going on with this Bitcoin.
Yeah.
So back to the mining part of it. Mining is essentially a computer network that's trying to solve complicated algorithms. And once it solves those, you're rewarded with some Bitcoin. You now own some Bitcoin. Okay.
Yeah.
And then another problem needs to be solved. And then more Bitcoin gets released. And the problems get harder and harder and harder to solve. and there's a limited supply of Bitcoin. I think it's 21 or 22 million total Bitcoins will ever be released, and that's it. Okay.
Okay.
Now, when I say this stuff, you need to realize, too, that I also don't understand it.
Yeah.
It's way above my brain's capacity. I don't get it. What's interesting is when you think about these miners, I'd read some stuff that boggled my mind. So people, the harder a computer has to work, the harder a computer computes to do things, it takes energy to do that. It pulls electricity to equal the computer power that's needed. So I don't think people think there's that direct correlation, but there is. As an example, if you went to the Facebook data center over here in Altoona, where they have rows and rows and rows and rows and rows of servers doing what they need to do, they built that building specifically so it could handle the heat that comes off of those when they do it. I think we've all had times where we like filled our computer tower and it's hot. Well, that's what's going on. It's working. It's creating heat.
Yeah.
So I read that already the amount of computer server space, et cetera, needed to try to mine for these Bitcoins is taking a huge amount of energy. The prediction is if it kept going by 2019, 2020, this was an article I read, just the mining of Bitcoins would be using more energy than the rest of the world combined when it takes electricity into account. And their point is, this is going to be damaging because they have to take it from somewhere.
Yeah.
That has to come from a power grid somewhere. And they sit in places like Venezuela that already has blackout issues. It's going to get worse and worse just because of mining Bitcoin. That's it. Currently, the article said that I read Bitcoin mining is like 27 times using more energy than the entire Visa network that exists now. And
okay.
You can imagine how large that would be.
Yeah, yeah.
So this is becoming a huge, huge problem.
I mean, I first heard about Bitcoin, it's probably been 5 years, really, since I first started hearing about it. And it was worth nothing.
It came out in 2009, and it took a while. It took a long while for it to get to $1,000 worth of value. But what's happened, probably a week ago, I'm going off of memory, but a week ago, I think Bitcoin, the articles were Bitcoin had hit 10,000, okay?
Mm-hmm.
We're a week later, it's at 15,000,
yeah.
Okay? Now, there's a history lesson in here that was called Tulip Mania, and it goes back to Holland and a shortage of tulips and how tulips became incredibly valuable overnight, right? So instead of paying 80 cents for a tulip, people are paying $400 for a tulip.
Okay.
And at the same time, it's like, it's a tulip.
Yeah.
There's no way it's worth $450, okay?
Right.
So people invested and had all these tulips, and then, of course, that market crashed because it's not sustainable, okay? Bitcoin is not backed by anything.
Right.
Okay, so you've got this thing. It's like, why is it going up in value? And the reason that you can come up with is supply and demand.
Right.
Okay, that's it.
Right.
But this thing is perched for, I think, an incredible fall.
Yeah.
Because you can't spend it. Okay. Well, at least in some places you can. But now you've got entities that are saying, we don't want to accept it. Because think about their position.
Because it's not worth anything.
Well, they accept it, right? They accept it.
Yeah.
They do some exchange at this $15,000 rate. And then tomorrow, the bottom falls out, and what they've just accepted is worthless.
Right.
So why would they take that risk? That's a big part of this. So it's kind of like stocks, right? People say, what are stocks? Well, stocks are backed by real companies with real people and real products and real mm-hmm. value, right? And they're proven over a long period of time. Bitcoin is this kind of flash in the pan, and if you got in early and are currently sitting where it's 15,000, you probably made a lot of money. I'm not saying nobody's
right.
made money on this thing, but it's like, what are you making money on? This thing will, for it to work, I think the only way it would work is it has to become widely accepted as currency
right.
that you can use anywhere that you go.
See, and that's where my problem with it is that it. I just think it's stupid. Like, it's one of those things that there's, you know, it's like a fad. Like, it's the cool thing to do is now have Bitcoin. And I don't know, maybe that's wrong, but...
But even that, like, some of your friend goes, I got some Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And you're going to be like, okay, well, now what?
Yeah, well, that's what I'm saying. Like, what? I feel like a normal person would just be like, okay, well, what does that mean?
Oh, I got to go buy Christmas presents for my family at Target. You'd be like, use some of that Bitcoin, man.
Yeah.
And you'd be like, I can't.
Yeah.
They don't take it.
Well, and then they want to say, or, you know, you can say, well, it's worth $15,000. You can sell it for $15,000. Okay, do it.
Yeah.
Go do it. Find someone to buy that from you for $15,000.
Yeah. So it's, you know, I guarantee, because of the number of people that listen to this, Adam Gray would say it's 10, slightly higher than that. Someone out there who's listening is invested in Bitcoin. I'm not saying that you're stupid for investing in Bitcoin, because clearly it's on this upward trajectory going to who knows where.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's any way that you look at this thing and think, this has bubble written all over it.
Right.
Based on that it's backed by nothing. You don't know who started it. You don't know even how it really works. Someone says, explain the algorithms that are needed to create new Bitcoin. That is, like, we're talking top-level mathematician-type stuff to even begin to understand what all that means. So it's interesting. If I had to put money in Bitcoin, I would put money in to short it, because I think it's going to ultimately fail.
Yeah.
The question is, does it fail tomorrow, or does it fail in a year, or what's going to happen? I don't know. But again, when large retailers are saying, we no longer accept it, that does not equal it should keep going up
right
in value.
I feel like the fact that it probably had all these articles and stuff written about it last week, there's all these people that didn't really know what it was.
Yeah.
They just like jumped on the train.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, this is worth a bunch of money now.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like I gotta get in on it.
Yeah.
And then it'll turn out that nobody knew what it was, and it just crashed, and everybody looks stupid.
It reminds me of Bernie Madoff. How many people heard from their friend, oh, I made so much money on Bernie Madoff. This guy does nothing but make money. And he did, but what we learned was it was all fake.
Yeah.
It was a Ponzi scheme. It was all fake. There was nothing real. I think people see money's being made, and they're blinded by greed, and they say, I'm going to get in on this now, without knowing what the heck this is, without doing any research on it, without knowing that you can't really spend it anywhere, et cetera.
Right.
And you got to caution those people. Of course, I don't know what's going to happen, but you can look at the signs on this thing and read from people that are very smart in these areas that say, I'm not touching this stuff. Mm-hmm. There's no way. So if you're like a Warren Buffett disciple and think that's a smart dude, he's not touching cryptocurrency at all. So are we eventually in society going to have cryptocurrency? Probably in some way. Everything goes digital. But this, I don't know, man. Don't put your money in it, Jared. Don't put your money in it.
I don't think I have enough money to put into it anyway. So
you could buy 1/10,000th of a Bitcoin.
Yeah, maybe I could.
And say, I own, I own Bitcoin. Okay, so I want to hop over to what's going on at Charterhouse Real Estate.
Cool.
Drum roll effect. Here's the big announcement. Okay. So what we're going to do at Charterhouse is, and I'm going to say why we're doing this other than that we're just doing it. As of tomorrow, Charterhouse Real Estate as a real estate firm closes. Okay. Our doors will literally still be open.
Uh-huh.
But Charterhouse as a firm does not exist as of tomorrow. We are merging with a company called Space Simply. And the guys over there already know I don't love that name. But hey, it is what it is. So
yeah.
Space Simply was started by a guy named Cy Phillips. Cy is a smart dude, really, really good at real estate. If we have rankings in real estate, these sheets that we can print out that show, because all of our sales are recorded on the MLS. And you can print these sheets out and see who has the most sales of the 2,000 or so agents that do what I do. And this year, when you look at that sheet, Cy is the number one guy on that sheet. Cy is very successful, knows what he's doing. So a couple years back, Cy was doing real estate in a normal way. Worked at Remax, charging 6-7%, whatever it was. That's kind of the standard. And Cy took a look at where the industry was going, and decided to start Space Simply under the premise that it is a flat fee brokerage. And essentially what that means is, on his side of the deal, on the listing agent side, as mm-hmm. we call it, when he goes and lists a house, there's really two commissions, one of the listing agent, one of the buyer's agent. That's the way it works. Cy charges $24.95 on his side, and then it's still 3% to the buyer's agent. This really starts to benefit people as they sell more and more expensive houses, because 3% of a $300,000 house is $9,000, or you can sell the same house with Cy at $24.95. So you can see where the savings are.
Right.
The lower end houses don't experience it quite as much, but maybe a little bit. So Cy started this method really under the premise that the lower price attracts more people, and not just people that don't have money. And these are a lot of wealthy people that just want to keep more of their money. So it's really kind of across the board. So Sy started this model thinking this is where the industry's headed. He's been kind of testing it, running with it for a couple of years. And the proof that it's doing well is in the sales. So I've known Sy for a while, you know, admired that he's successful in real estate. That's tough to do. And had a lunch with him on my birthday about a month ago. And we weren't really talking about merging, but we were just talking about the industry. And the more he was saying, the more I was thinking, you know what, he's onto something. There's word of some national type competitors coming into our market that do some lower cost things. So I started to think, you know what, I agree with him. I think the market is shifting more towards people want great service,
yeah,
but they don't want to pay 6%, 7%. That's a lot of money. So I started toying with that and saying, what's the way to do this? And I didn't want to lose the name Charterhouse because I spent 2 years building it. A lot of people know what it is now. Not everybody, but a lot of people. Didn't want to lose the brand identity either. Mm-hmm. So for in the future, who knows what's going to happen if I need to go back to an independent firm, I could. The other thing that's interesting too is this opens the door to get into business with a lot of people that are trying to do it themselves. FSBOs, as we call them, for sale by owners. One interesting way to look at this in the model is if you're thinking about selling your own house and hiring some help. So I'm not talking about the people that are doing it totally on their own, but hiring some help. A good example is a company here called FSBOHomes.com. FSBO Homes has a model where they charge you $500 up front, and then when you close, it's another $1,000 and away you go. Okay, so that's $1,500. In most transactions, I think the numbers are in the 80s, 80% or so. The buyer that comes on that house is represented by an agent. Okay. They have an agent, okay? And that agent wants to be paid, typically 3%. So as a for sale by owner, if you start the premise that, okay, I'm going to try to do it myself, maybe with a little help from this company, but I'm willing to give the 3%, then you just know, okay, I've got an 80% chance of having to part with that money. If you start at that premise, then you say, okay, this FSBO company is $1,500 on top of that, but I don't get on the MLS. I don't have an agent that has a fiduciary interest to me mm-hmm. that's looking out for my best interest. They're just kind of a clearinghouse. They're a company that exists to help you with a few things. So for $1,000 more than that, I do get on the MLS. I get full exposure. I get agent help. I get negotiate all of that stuff. Then it becomes tricky for a FSBO to think that the best deal is the FSBO route when they can go full service.
Keep talking. I'm going to plug my computer in.
There you go. So the in combination of thinking that we're going to be able to attract more for sale by owners in combination with the fact that we're able to save sellers money. A lot of sellers end up turning into buyers. And on the buyer side of things, the paycheck ends up being substantially more than on the seller side. We made the decision to join forces and merge with them. This change will be effective tomorrow. Charterhouse is going to be a team office under their umbrella. So again, we'll still be in our same office. People will still drive by and see a Charterhouse sign. There's some legal stuff behind the scenes as far as how that's structured, how that goes. But the reality, so I guess what I want to tell people is, one, the change is happening.
I'll ask a question.
Yeah.
What does this mean for people that want to come in and work with you?
Yeah, so that does change in a way. On the selling side, what it means is you're likely going to be charged less money for the same thing.
Okay.
Good news for them. On the buying side, that's where there's a change too. In order for this model to work, I also have to change the structure of how I did things. There's been many people over the years via the podcast that have reached out to me and said, we want to buy a home. And when those phone calls happened, I said, that's great, welcome, and now I'm going to introduce you to Amy and Sarah.
Yeah.
And they're going to go help you find a house. That is changing in the future. I'm going to be back in that role of helping people go out and find a house. So for those of you out there that are just dying to spend time with me, there's got to be like one out there, and you call and
it's
say,
your brother.
Hey, yeah. If you call and say, hey, I want to buy a house, then now the way this new model works, I'm going to be the one that's going to be helping you do that. So that is a significant change. It's one that I had to think a lot about. And I'll be the first one to say, if someone says, I want to look, you know, every day for the next 3 weeks in Earlham, I'm probably not going to be the guy for them, because I've got other things going on. But if it's metro-based and, you know, they're a good client, then yeah, I will be the ones working with them. So it's an interesting change. It's an interesting change from the perspective of Sy's got another guy over there named Neil. Neil's a top seller. I'm going to be joining those guys. So now you've got several people with this, within this business that are doing this flat fee model.
Yeah.
It's not like, okay, it's not going to work. These guys won't make it. We'll absolutely make it. I think we'll do very, very well collectively with this model. Otherwise, I wouldn't be doing it. But it will, day by day, piece by piece, be an industry changer. I acknowledge that it's tough for agents at other firms to go into living rooms and compete with us when we're going to say it's $24.95 plus 3%, and they're saying it's 6 or 7%. That's very, very, very tough for them.
Right.
And that's just the nature of any business, right? Businesses shift and change, and you've got to adapt the way that you do things. So it's a new change. It's an exciting change. I don't envision the forecast changing. I think this is going to continue as long as Williams wants to keep doing it, frankly. And I welcome, you know, talking with clients about it. And if they want to know more, I can certainly do that. But yeah, as of tomorrow, we're changing. So
I know you'd talked about,
we'll see how it goes.
I know you'd talked about how you were, you know, possibly hiring some new people. What does this, you know, mean for all that stuff?
Yeah. So with any transition, yeah, you've got change like that. So what has happened was we had basically four agents outside of me currently. Mm-hmm. Nick, Amy, Shauna, Sarah. Nick and Amy are staying here. Sarah's going to a different firm. Shauna's going to a different firm, which is fine. We wish them luck. They have to share the vision on why I'm doing what I'm doing and want to be part of it. I think they see some opportunities elsewhere, so that's fine. And then we have four or five rookies that are all still coming on. None of them have changed their mind. They all still want to be part of it and see the benefits of it. So, yes, we're going through change as well. We'll see how it goes. There's a possibility, if it goes well, that I'll want to bring on more mm-hmm. agents. But, yeah, ultimately what I've told everybody is I'm not doing something intentionally to hurt people, to make it so they want to leave. This is something that I think – will ultimately benefit everybody.
Yeah.
I think everybody will be busier collectively. I think everybody will make more money. All of those things. So
it might be, I think it could probably be hard for some people to see that just based on the, you know, how you explain the numbers of it.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. And it's, you know, I'm the first to admit that there's going to be a time where I go and sell, I list a house for $15,000. And I'm at the closing table, and I see the other agent's check is $15,000, mm-hmm. and mine's $2,500. Right. In that moment, you're going to say that sucked. Okay, but it is a bigger picture to this. It's okay. Maybe I never met the client that I got the $2,500 on, and let's not dismiss $2,500. It's still a lot of money, but let's not dismiss it and say it's insignificant because now I've met the client. If I did a good job, then their friends are going to hear about it. Maybe that seller has become a buyer,
right?
And there's a larger check there. So it is a big picture scenario to this type of business. It, you know, the haters out there, and there's always going to be some, are going to make the comparison of, you know, think of fast food versus fine dining, right? Okay, you're Taco Bell and we're something, you know, we're Fleming's.
Right.
And to answer that argument, if someone were to make it, I would say, you know what? What we're doing now at this $2,500 is no different at all than what we were doing when we were charging 5%. And people viewed that as full service, and it's still full service. It's simply we're charging less money. And
yeah.
Some people think, well, if you're charging less, you have to be offering less or doing less or whatever. Not if you know what you're doing in the business, not if you're streamlined in the way you do it, if you use you know, online systems efficiently and all of those things, this industry can certainly be done well at this new model. And again, I go back to Sy's been doing it for a couple of years and proving that. So we're excited about it. If anyone says, man, I'd really like to use Charterhouse, but they charge too much, try us again. Tomorrow, yeah. It's going to be different and less. So yeah, excited for the change. I do think the industry is heading more and more and more towards flat fee, lower commissions than it is now. And just like Bitcoin, I could be wrong on that too, but I don't know. So anyway, that's,
are you going to start accepting Bitcoin? Next question.
No, I'm not. So that's the big change. We hope it goes well. But before we take off, I know we're running up against it. We obviously got to get a prediction for, 6 hours from now.
Yeah.
We got a basketball game. How is this game going to shape up?
I think Iowa State will win. It's based on what I've seen of Iowa. I've obviously watched all of the Iowa State games, but I just think that this team matches up better with Iowa than what we might have thought they would early in the season. And I don't think Iowa's found themselves yet.
Yeah.
I think that Iowa will be a good team in, you know, February, January, February, March. But right now, I just don't think that they know how the pieces come together.
What is Iowa's breakdown of classes? Seniors, sophomores, juniors, freshmen. What do they have for their starting five?
They're relatively young.
Yeah.
The thing that is weird to me, and I was doing wrote my preview yesterday, they hit 10 – they have 10 guys that are 6'7 or taller, mm-hmm. and they have 12 guys that are 6'5 or taller of 14 people on their roster.
That's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have a lot of guys that are that would fit the mold of a, you know, a 3, 4, 5.
Yep.
And that bodes well for Iowa State to me because I think they can create some mismatch problems.
Yep.
And those guys that are playing the 3, 4, 5 don't fit together to me very well from what I've seen. But I guess we'll see.
So Iowa State wins. I agree with that. But what type of game is it going to look like? What's your final score prediction for this thing?
This is one of those games that you have to throw the records out to me. So I think it's going to be a good game.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure that it'll be back and forth for a lot of the time. I'd say Iowa State by, what's the line, 6 now?
5 or 6.
Yeah. I'd say Iowa State by about 6 or 7.
Okay.
You know, so it's like a game where they have to seal it at the end with some free throws.
Yeah.
And, but yeah, I mean, I think Iowa State will win the game.
The thing that's interesting, I was talking to Chris about this a little bit last week, is that we as fans get super jacked up and it's the rivalry game, et cetera. And Iowa has players with that Iowa connection that maybe it means something to them. Iowa State does not.
Yeah.
So I know that they've been doing some things to maybe pump up the rivalry aspect of this because we can't expect them to care in the same way that a fan does and say, come on, guys, it's Iowa, when they're not from here. They don't give a crap.
Right.
So not to say – I mean, the fans will be jacking them up tonight. There's no question about that. But you have to also remind yourself it's like it is just kind of a game
for some of these guys. I think for some of those guys, once you experience it one time
– yeah.
You kind of understand.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And when they get into Hilton Coliseum tonight and they see how jacked up everybody is and you see that they're – I mean, I'm sure that there's people already waiting in line to get in the student section.
Because they have not played a game yet at home that's going to be anywhere close to this. This will be their first impression of playing as a player at Iowa State with that type of crowd.
And I was reading a thing. Aaron Marner from the Iowa State Daily wrote a – really good oral history of the 2015 game,
yep.
the one when Monte hit the shot at the end.
Yeah, yeah.
And Gary Wade, is that his name, the PA announcer?
Yeah.
He was talking about how in that game you could feel the floor mm-hmm. rippling underneath you because mm-hmm. of how loud it was.
Yeah.
That it doesn't take long in this kind of game. You get on a big run, that kind of thing starts happening.
Do that.
And these guys will all of a sudden will be like, oh my God, this is a big deal.
The other famous game that I've heard that same story about was back when Hoiberg played against Okie State.
Yeah.
Okie State came in and it was, you know, big upset for us, a huge game. And a lot of people said the floor was shaking, which it would. I mean, they just lay the floor down basically over cement. I mean, it's gonna get loud.
I remember that from the when Naz hit the shot against Oklahoma State.
Yeah,
that was. I think it was a lot like that as well.
Yeah, the deep three. At the buzzer.
Yeah.
Well, we'll hope for a good game. I'm taking my 6-year-old up there, and it'll probably be the rowdiest game he's ever been to.
Oh yeah, I'm sure.
So we'll get a clone cone.
Come by, say what's up. We'll be.
Are you still in those same spots?
Yep, we are. It's me and Kay Fitzy tonight. I don't think you've ever met him before.
I haven't.
Yeah, he. I don't think he's ever covered a game, so this is gonna be an interesting experience.
I'm curious, and maybe tonight I'll find out, or maybe you already know. But I was curious where the new president's gonna sit. Same seats.
See, I was told that they just sold those seats.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, I know.
So apparently not. They're not sitting there.
Leith like to be right down there in the action, and I know someone else might not want to be down there in the action. So I'll have to look down there and see you bottom, see if I recognize that person. So I did want to plug one more thing real quick because we've done it before. The 9th, Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
Saturday night, Paul Shirley's in town at Old Main. I think it's $20 gets you a drink, a book, and I think a subscription to the Ames Tribune, if I read it right, like for 3 months or something like that.
Yeah.
Kind of odd, but hey, it is what it is.
Well, I think they're the ones putting on the event.
They probably are.
Yeah.
So, you know, if you're not a Paul Shirley hater, and I don't think you should be, I think, you know, what you thought about him before has probably changed as he's grown up. Go down and buy a book and shake his hand and remember, at least he was a Cyclone.
Right.
So, and I've read the book, and the book's good. So that's, I don't know what time it's at, 7 o'clock, probably, something like
Something like that. I think it's, you can probably Google it.
Yeah.
And find it rather easily.
Use that friend named Google. So ironically, I can't go. I'm plugging in. I can't go. I've got a Christmas party. I wish I could, but that should be fun. Anything else to plug?
I don't think so. CF Radio tonight, Jeff Woody and I.
The bowl trip coming along good for Fanatic?
Yeah, I think it's fine. Last I heard, it was actually sold out, so.
Okay.
I don't know if they added more rooms. That's not my area of expertise.
Okay. I'm sure Williams would plug it if he was here, but he's not. So there you go. All right, guys. That's it. We'll tune in next week, and I think Chris Williams will be here, and I don't know what the heck we're talking about because it's the Fogcast, but tune in to find out.